This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 23rd of August. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng and Sharad Kutin. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Sharad, you've got a bit of a cough going on.
I have a frog in my throat.
Frog, yes.
Permanently lodged there, is it? Okay, well...
I hope it's not permanent. I hope it's temporary.
Yeah. I think you need some coffee. Coffee will just cure everything. I have a fisherman's friend,
which has since become my best friend.
Okay, it's not quite coffee, but it'll do for now.
A radio announcer's best friend.
Do you mean coffee or like cough... Why?
Not really as an anecdote, but because it makes you feel better.
Of course.
Coffee always does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
It's like the elixir of the industrial age.
In fact, I think coffee is a kind of drug that people have not banned, and I'm very glad about that.
No, absolutely. No. In fact, I think much of industrial life would not function
without coffee.
Without coffee and cigarettes.
And the biggest crime
I think so.
Because the biggest crime you can have is to put decaf in the office coffee machine. That's the biggest crime.
I think it's self-defeating. I think what employers should do to improve worker productivity is, in fact, to kind of up the level of caffeine and just get everybody zinging, you know.
Caffeine patches.
That's no fun.
Oh, then
you can't really taste. It's like having a wine patch.
Sherlock... Holmes, the television series Michael Cumberbatch?
No, Benedict Cumberbatch. Michael.
That's just like winging it there. He wears patches because nicotine patches, and so when he's doing his best work, he wears three.
When you read Arthur Conan Doyle, right? Uh-huh. It talks about Sherlock Holmes being a chemist and at the same time a drug abuser as well, because he shoots himself up with heroin every now and then, and he will ask that sidekick
Watson.
Yeah, hey Watson, would you like some to shoot up some
Tonto? No, I think it's very interesting. I think there was a period when things like those kinds of chemicals, including opium, were not kind of like seen as bad.
Seen as a stimulant for creativity.
Very experimental.
So
if Sherlock Holmes does it.
There's a Timothy Leary moment here. We're not promoting the use of substances.
We're just promoting reading. We are,
yes. Literature, that's right. We're going to keep you company over the next 4 hours with lots of news and interviews. On the Breakfast Grill today, I will be speaking to Ezam Shah Ismail, Dean of the School of Professional Studies at the International Center for Education in Islamic Finance. It's better known as INSEF in the Islamic finance circles. Quite interesting times to look at the talent development for Islamic finance, because, as much as this industry wants to grow, you can't grow it if you don't have the right people who are able to work in it, right, with the specific skills. So already anticipating the demand for Islamic finance talent more than a decade ago, Bank Negara had set up INSEF about in 2005, and they've churned out about 2,000 graduates every year. But still, I think there's still more that needs to be done for this industry, because as a percentage of conventional banking in terms of banking assets, Islamic finance globally is still in the single digits. So it's still quite small.
I mean, I'm just wondering whether you're talking about just another different financial and banking product, or you're talking about how to deal with consumers of financial products, because I think that if it's just another product, and then it would be quite easily to just include it into your arsenal of knowledge. Mm. I think bankers, whether they're in Malaysia, Dubai, England, London or Hong Kong, would have no problem incorporating this new product, this new category of Islamic finance into your product knowledge, right?
But in terms of
how you deal with your customer who's, let's say, Muslim, then perhaps that's a different thing. But I guess with Islamic.
You mean that would require different meaning? It would require more work.
It might require a knowledge of how to deal with your customer. But you see, with these financial products, they are very sophisticated and very advanced. And the users of these products are usually professional financial managers. And they would just treat it as just another, you know, like an option trade or some other exotic product. Yeah. Which is growing in size.
I think the idea for NCF is to come up with people who can innovate from, you know, not just existing products, but come up with new clever new ideas within Islamic finance. So it's not to copy what conventional has already done and, you know, put a Sharia compliant spin on it, but to come up with new innovative structures. And to actually do that is you have to understand the structures of the Murabahas contracts, the Musharaka structures. All of this requires, you know, further understanding of Islamic finance, not just the introductory level of no riba, no gara, etc.
Okay, so it's not just cosmetic. It's actually
it has to be.
But what's interesting about you know, the kind of Muslim market, as it were, if you want to call it that. I mean, just look at what EPF did recently and the crowds. I mean, EPF was completely overwhelmed by people wanting to move their funds into something that was kind of Sharia compliant.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's only a logical and next step that what EPF is doing. And in fact, the 100 billion that they allocated out of the about 700 billion assets under management, I think it's just a self-imposed kind of limit, because I think in the short term, what they're doing is just transferring Islamic assets to the Islamic fund. But if they open the floodgates, there would not be enough assets to buy in Malaysia.
Yeah. Well, so Islamic finance, a topic of discussion on The Breakfast Grill. And today, did you know today, August 23rd, is actually the International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its abolition?
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't realize that.
The abolition. Isn't that quite a fluid date?
So the question, one specific day, right? So I think the question really is, no, it's just you choose a day to remember it. It's not that the abolition happened in one particular day.
Right,
but of course, we're talking maybe about one particular moment in world history where slavery was massive, which is the transatlantic slave trade that we kind of think of when you think of Alex Haley and Roots and, you know, that experience in
Kunta
America.
Kinte.
Absolutely, right? So he was the first, the progenitor of that story.
Was that a true historical figure?
Yes, that was his name.
It wasn't an artistic creation?
I don't think so, because Alex Haley did that historical research to tell that story. But, you know, I mean, I was just looking today, a couple of days ago at a new book that's come out to talk about Native North Americans who were slaved.
Oh.
And, you know, all the forms of slavery that the Native population of North America was subjected to during the early part of the colonization of the continent. And in fact, you know, if you look at world history, slavery has been all over, including in the peninsula. So the slaving of Orang Asli in the peninsula by, you know, the feudal regimes of and the sultanates of basically of the Malay Peninsula.
I think the slavery still lasts till today in its very insidious forms. I mean, if you look at all the, you know, construction sites and how human trafficking happens in this part of the world.
So then we move into a different category.
Modern day slavery.
What is it? Right? Because we had all kinds of forms, bondage and...
Well, actually, there was a global slavery index that was released recently that indicated modern day slavery may still be a problem in Malaysia today. The report estimated 129,000 people in Malaysia living in conditions amounting to modern-day slavery. A majority of these people are women and children who came to the country as domestic workers. So there you go. We're going to be looking at this, given that today is the International Day for Remembrance of the slave trade. So we want to look at modern-day slavery. If migrant domestic workers fall into this category, if you are guilty of doing this, so
that's confining your maid, you know,
holding their passport, you know, that's considered holding without permission or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the exact term is. Yeah, so that's our topic of focus on current affairs today. And at 9:35 a.m., the BBC Global Business Series comes on. This week, virtual reality technology. And it's here, virtual reality, but it's mainly being used for fun up till now. However, things are about to change because the BBC is now saying VR could change our lives and revolutionize the way the world of business. So, you know, it could put us in two places at once, for example. It could replace the need for many painkillers. It could even help cure psychological problems. You know, like if you have a phobia, then you could use. So, Jules, there's a difference between virtual reality and augmented reality, right? I always get confused.
That's right, yeah.
What's the difference? Well,
if you're playing Pokemon, that's augmented because you don't put on a helmet. But if you are putting on something, a device onto your head and changing your environment and that's all you can see, that's virtual.
That's virtual, okay. So it's like those goggles that you see, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, having played Pokemon myself.
You have? Oh my God, Shirai.
I did. No.
I would have never guessed.
It was purely anthropological, meaning I wanted to participate and observe.
Sure.
And,
you know,
are we going to hear about Pokemon anytime soon on Night School or something?
I don't see why Night School would not take up a topic like virtual reality or even mass obsession and mass hysteria. All I can say is that I did it for a while. I got to level 5 when I could actually go to a gym and fight. And I tried to die the beautiful death, you know, just fight to the death.
I think you should just take up wrestling. Like,
but it was
real
too tedious,
physical.
So I uninstalled. Oh, that was the way to die. That's how you die in augmented reality. You uninstall.
I would have never guessed Sherrod Kutin would be playing Pokemon. Good
did
for
you, try,
you.
Did you try?
No. I don't understand it.
Yeah, but you know,
it's too
it holds out.
No, it's not.
VR.
Is it not?
VR actually holds out a lot of potential and not to mention excitement in especially the games world, the gaming world, right? Where your home can be the battleground for new games. You can like kill monsters in the comfort of your living room.
Yeah.
Actually, it's quite creepy, I must say. I woke up one night, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I happened to, you know, look at my phone, and there was a Pokemon in my bedroom.
God.
But it was one of those kind of like lava-looking ones. Yeah, it would have been scarier if it was one of those rat-like things, the Rattata, what they call it. Which that, actually, because it leaps out at you.
They should have a horror version, like a Ju-on version.
It is.
Oh,
the
my
monster.
Goodness.
It is horror.
I would never touch that. I swear, I would never. Okay, well, let's very quickly take a look at the news roundup. Late last night, former Singapore President S.R. Nathan passed away at Singapore's General Hospital, the age of 92. If you remember, at the end of July, he had a stroke and was in critical condition in the ICU unit at the Singapore General Hospital there. So he passed away last night.
That's a really healthy dose of longevity with Singapore leaders. I mean, Lee Kuan Yew and his wife as well died into the 90s. And here is the ex-president also dying at 92. So,
But they had a president who died young, though.
Okay.
Died of cancer. So, you know, so that's happened too. It's not all of them. Dev and I died. I think many of their presidents did die reasonably into old age. Ong Teng Cheong, I believe, who was a former cabinet minister, he died. He had cancer and died reasonably young, I think.
Well, Nathan was the longest serving president in Singapore in office for 2 terms from 1999 to 2011. So I believe the latest details on this is that they will be having a funeral service for him on Friday.
Yeah. You know, there was also a recent announcement that by Lee Hsien Loong, who's now, of course, on leave, medical leave, saying that, ethnic minorities to be... I'm not quite sure the details that they would there would be an effort to make sure that ethnic minorities become presidents in Singapore.
By changing the constitution.
By changing the constitution. You know, because the constitution has changed somewhat from the ceremonial role it had in the early days of the republic to one where they started electing the president. So Ong Teng Cheong, the one president I just mentioned, he was the first popularly elected president. But the first three presidents of Singapore were, in fact, from ethnic minorities. It started with Yusof Ishak and then Benjamin Sheares, who is Eurasian, and then Devan Nair. C.V. Devanai, who is Indian. So, you know, so the first three. In fact, I think of the seven presidents Singapore's had, four of them have been ethnic minorities.
So the position is still largely ceremonial, except for the fact that since the 91 constitutional amendments you were talking about gave the president certain powers, like on government expenditure and financial services. Yeah. And some appointments to key public offices.
Yeah, in fact, it was quite a controversial move in those days, because one of the concerns was, in fact, the loss of ethnic minority representation. Now, the whole effort to make sure that the head of state, in some ways, represented Singapore, not in some sort of equivalence for the demographic majority. So, because you have a majority Chinese population, therefore your president should be Chinese. But in fact, to have an ethnic minority, in some ways, to kind of say, well, the president is for everybody. Right?
That's very progressive.
Yeah, it was, and therefore, so there was concern that this shift away towards an executive presidency, using the rationale of protecting reserves, would in fact undermine this particular function. And because it's proven to be very difficult to even stand for president, they've not been always competitive, these presidential elections. But all the same, you know, we had the individuals like S.R. Nathan, who's become, through the elected system, president of Singapore.
Okay, it's 16 minutes past 6 o'clock. After this, more news. So stay tuned on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones there. Good morning, 6:20 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng and Sharad Kutan. Now, the Olympics may be over, but we're still running high on adrenaline and love for sport, I guess.
And Pokemon. In fact, I'm just reading here, two men were arrested for getting into a fight over Pokemon Go in Singapore.
It's terrible. I was in a park yesterday having a run, and everyone was just milling about playing with their Pokemon.
Yeah, well,
in the park, and it's just takes up space.
Well, I was at a shopping mall over the weekend, and so many people just loitering around trying to catch.
No, not loitering, because loitering suggests no purpose.
Oh, sorry.
When you're
sorry.
Playing Pokemon Go,
walking
right.
around,
you have very definite purpose. What I'm shocked by is these two men who were caught fighting in Singapore were aged 28 and 33, which makes them not really children, makes them adults with the heart of children,
violent
children.
About?
Well, I saw a woman in her 60s playing Pokemon, and she was exclaiming in Chinese, "Oh, I got it."
It's a game for all ages there. But, you know, there are some sports that are split into different categories, age, gender, whether you are able-bodied or special, like the Paralympics and the Olympics. Now, in this recent Olympics, South Africa's Caster Semenya has become one of the most talked about track and field athletes, but not in the way she might have hoped. The intersex athlete had picked up the gold in the 800 meters women's competition after charting a time of 1:58, very impressive. But then she's been put through some, you know, a lot of scrutiny by the media and the public simply because she is intersex.
And, you know, the question, of course, and I'm going to, you know, put the link to the story, is what do you do with these categories that we have with sports? We've had able-bodied, and then which we kind of didn't name as able-bodied until we had the special or Paralympics.
Mm-hmm.
Which then defined this able-bodied, disabled division. And then we also have always had a male and female gender categories. Sometimes we have mixed categories in order to have both. But it's as if in the world, you only had these two categories of male and female. And of course, we know that's not true. That scientifically, and because throughout our history, we've had all kinds of people. And the intersex, the recognition of intersex individuals is a real problem for events, you know, that kind of define. Think of the Academy Awards, yeah. Best Supporting Actress, Best Supporting Actor. What would you do with an individual who's intersex?
Well, yeah.
Would you base it on the character they played or the real person, right?
I mean, I think it's not so glaring in an Academy Award event, but with a sports event, there are certain physical advantages of being endowed a certain way. So the question is whether we are progressive enough to create another category for this group of people. I'm sure that she has this... possibly unfair advantage over the other women.
Yeah, so she, Casta has a condition called hyperandrogenism, which means she has higher levels of testosterone in her body. Does that make her faster than a woman who does not have those same levels of testosterone, right?
It's interesting because it's not clear that that's the fact, because fast women would run faster than any, you know, most men, right? So,
I don't know about the competitive level. At a competitive level, every little bit counts, right?
It could be, but I think it's a question of science, one. The other thing, of course, is, Julian, you said, do we create another category? Mm. Is that the way to go? I mean, in, say, the question of toilets, say, Thailand instituted this thing where you would have toilets for intersex individuals to make them comfortable, right? So you had three options, male, female, and intersex. But do we want to create more categories, or do we want to blur the lines and take away those categories?
You're afraid of divisions and a certain level of polarization, but with sports, it's really different because it's about physical advantage, physical advantages. So to take a very extreme example, if an able-bodied person competed in the Paralympics, then that's unfair.
Except in the run, and if they went up against Oscar Pistorius, they might actually lose.
Well, yeah, that's an exception, right? But we're talking about where the lines of categorization and fair competition, where they are drawn.
But fair to whom, right? Because someone else competing in that event, you know, the stakes are high, right? We're talking milliseconds here. And I wonder, I remember a similar case in wrestling, if I'm not mistaken. Was a transgender woman who was competing in the women's category for wrestling. And, you know, again, testosterone and having the, and I say this with generalizing, having the strength of a male, right? Does that not put her in an unfair advantage in the ring?
Well, you know, so this is, again, these are interesting questions, right? Because Caster Semenya's body type is a function of her chromosomal makeup, right? What chromosomes she was endowed with. Mm-hmm. But you could say that about any other individual. Michael Phelps, right? His body type is also a function of his chromosome, right?
Yes, but his competing in a category that's made for him.
Yeah, I know. So I'm saying is that even within those categories, the genetic makeup of the individual will give them an advantage, right? So why penalize Caster for having that advantage?
Because I think it
blurs the lines of the categories.
Not only does it blur the line, because there is a very real possibility that you will change completely the face of sports in the selection process. If you have a selection process where people go around looking for people like Caster Semenya, then eventually that category would be kind of transformed in a very profound way.
Why don't men and women compete against each other in the Olympics in an indirect competition? Like, why not?
Well, you have the mixed doubles with tennis and badminton.
Exactly.
But that's where both the two sides are equalized in terms of strength and power.
Well, the assumption being that women bring something other than strength and power to the game.
Women are the weaker sex and therefore cannot compete head-to-head with a male. Yeah. So in a game like badminton, for instance, I mean, I understand that you have you need a certain kind of physical strength, but it's also about skill, right?
You know, this is such an interesting question that you asked, Melissa. And I remember, one way of kind of looking at it is, I remember the 70s when they had these kind of like gender wars. I think they were kind of like, they called sex wars, but meaning...
Feminism.
Because gender was not the preferred term, right? It was sex. Sex means boys and girls. And I remember Billie Jean King going up against some other tennis player, but they gave her a slight advantage in terms of the court size in order to kind of... equal
like a handicap.
Yeah, like a little handicap, right?
What was that handicap?
I think it was the size of the court or something. It was something weird. I can't really remember, but I remember that women sometimes were given a certain handicap. It didn't always apply. So in playing pool, for instance, because I remember, the pool game again, a man against a woman. But there was all these attempts to kind of say, well, what is the line? What do we mean by equality in a level playing field? You know, because. Like I think, you know, the fastest women, probably much faster than most men. But you're right, men typically have certain advantages when it comes to running because smaller hip size and stuff like that. But that's not true of all men. And what about the women who do have smaller hip size? Do they penalize them for seeming like manly in their body structure?
I wonder whether in the future, you know, not Tokyo, but in one of the Olympics in the future, we might see an event where women and men compete on a really equal level playing field. I mean, going head to head and seeing
How do you equalize the playing field? Do you institute some form of a handicap?
Well, just I went to see Usain Bolt against Caster Semenya, right? Just go at it and see whether who wins. Right?
Yeah.
My money's on Usain Bolt though. That man can run.
And maybe the future of sports is in fact to kind of move away from the idea of natural and artificial advantages, and you know, allow doping, as it were.
I don't feel so right about it, because I think that human beings can be very sneaky and create ways to get advantage, and therefore I think if you put them all into the same category, you would abuse drugs and so on.
Okay, it's 6:30 now. We've got the news bulletin coming up next with Nadia Aziz on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, It's My Life by Talk Talk. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run, 6:40 right now. Sharad Kutan, Julian Ng, and me, Melissa Idris, keeping you company this morning.
You know, I'm going to tweet out the link to the Billie Jean King match. I just did a little research, and she fought Bobby Riggs, and that was 1973. I was exactly 7 years old, and it made such an impression on me.
Wow! You also telling us. Sorry, yeah.
Did she play with a man?
She played against the man, Bobby Riggs.
Okay.
He had also played against another woman tennis player in another televised match. It was called Battle of the Sexes.
Did she win?
I haven't looked. I can't remember.
Okay.
But they no did, spoilers.
I was correct about it. It did have hybrid rules that favored Billie Jean King, or favored the women in the two matches.
Okay.
So, but still, you know, in the 70s, I think there was just so much concern about these issues, and I think today we are increasingly aware about the intersex issue. A brilliant Argentinian movie, if you want to watch. It's got 82% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, you know, Julian holds his nose up against these things, nothing less than 90%, he says. But I think it was a brilliant, sensitive movie about parents and choices they have to make for their young child who is intersex. It's called XXY. It's available on
Netflix.
Netflix.
Netflix, yeah. And XXY refers to a chromosome in our bodies, right?
Yeah, right. So we're all born typically XX for women, XY for men, and then of course all other kinds of combinations also exist in the world.
Okay, so that's XXY, the movie that you're referring, not XXX. That's a different movie. XXX is a different one.
That's actually a category.
Yeah, it is. Okay. All right. Well, let's take a look at the recent research paper by Stephen Levitt from the University of Chicago. In fact, he's the man behind Freakonomics and the podcast Freakonomist. So Freakonomics, that's right, the podcast. He suggested that apparently people are too cautious for their own good. Now, he's not talking about the small stakes decision. He's talking about the big life choices, like whether to quit a job or to get out of a relationship. He says we're far too cautious. In fact, we might be better off just tossing a coin and making that decision using a coin flip.
But do you think, so what is he suggesting? That people should not be risk averse and should go for broke when it comes to things like relationships and jobs?
Apparently, he asked listeners and readers of his book and listeners of his podcast to help him out by giving him details of a big decision they were struggling with, and then to witness a coin toss to help them make up their mind. So he then kind of did a follow-up with them twice a month after a few months, and made notes about how happy they were. And he found out that people who made the big change said that they were far happier than those who didn't, regardless of what their coin flip was. So it doesn't matter what your coin flip turned out to be. You just have to make a decision. You'll end up being happier.
Yeah, I think the coin flip actually brings attention to your life decision and puts you in a place where you got to think about it a lot more. But I think that the research itself, the process of calling this a research is is quite interesting yeah. because it really depends on a certain demographic of people calling in, writing in, listening to his podcast. I mean, the number of people going online narrows it down to a certain category. So the end result of what the research is suggesting may not be applicable to everybody.
A wide base, right? I mean, we're talking about readers of the Financial Times and the Forbes. So it's a
who
certain demographic.
Are already set up in a certain way in life. But I do like the fact that he is asking us to be a little bit more risky in our decision making, because if we are
or risk of less risk,
less averse,
or
yeah.
even become riskier in our way of thinking, because we are too confined by our, you know, I guess rightly so, bread and butter issues as well as our social strictures.
How do you guys make big decisions when you're faced with a big decision to make? Do you just go with gut feel, or do you make a pro-con list, or do you
crowdsource?
Talk to a lot of people, you know, yeah. find out what advice people are telling you. How do you make big decisions?
I think it really depends on the decisions, but yeah, I often seek the counsel of some good friends, my brother. Mm. But also, I think in others, they have been, when I've really taken risks, I think it's been because I had a very strong conviction that this was the right course, and I didn't mind adverse consequences. I mean, I had decided that I could deal with
when you decide negative, to do something, yeah. just
yeah, yeah. That, you know, the negative fallout. I was, you know, advised against doing certain things, and I said, well, okay, fine. If it turns out this way, so be it. And I was willing to go that way. I think that's how, you know, so you kind of resolve to be happy if things turn out well, but also to be you know, reconciled to a negative result.
Yeah, I often turn inward and I kind of go hide in my shell and think, go in my head, right? And then I do this pro-con list where I list all the pros and the cons, and then I throw that list out and just go with my gut. So I'm really quite iffy when it comes to making big decisions. I think I'm with you on that level, Sharad. I have to have real conviction before I can make a move.
Yeah, for me, I think it's... I've been always avoiding big decisions, the painful process of deciding, you know, whether to do something or not. But I guess right now it is a mission in my life to really face the big ones, right? And really think about it. Otherwise, you know, I'll just Google it and say and ask Google. What should I do?
Okay. Julie, when you are giving financial advice, when you're giving or even sharing your opinions on air about, say, investments in the stock market and such, you're not telling people to be less risk averse. You're actually cautioning them against taking risky you know, challenges, right? I mean, it seems to me that listening to you over the years that you... in some sense, risk could also be mm-hmm. irresponsibility or a lack of being lacking responsibility.
Yeah, I think when you're dealing with assets that you've already built up or have not built up, but are trying to build up a certain asset to give you a degree of financial freedom, it's no longer about what the kind of risk that you can take as a young person. It's really about the protection of your wealth. And it has to do a lot with game theory as well. For example, you know, in tennis, the first serve is always much more risky than the second serve, right? You go all out in the first serve, and if you fault that, your second serve... 25% to 35% slower, ball speed slower than the first serve. It's all about loss avoidance and protecting what you already have. Same thing with a lot of other games like poker. Instead of bluffing all the time in poker, you want to protect your chips by... And bluffing is an overrated strategy in poker. You want to just play with the good hands that you have. So a lot of times with advice on financial assets and wealth, it's all about wealth protection. protection and wealth preservation.
Jules, just coming back to the topic of tennis that you just mentioned, Billie Jean King actually won that match you were talking about.
Oh, that's a spoiler.
Well, it was 1972, so I think I'm a little okay here with the spoilers.
73. Yeah. Jules, you were born. You were already around.
You were born.
I was around. I probably wasn't than interested in tennis. Probably another than Star Wars, maybe. Oh, Muhammad Ali.
Oh, right. Yeah. I was just interested in TV and everything that flashed past.
Well, the Wall Street Journal also came out with an article to say that there is an upside to feeling down. Apparently, you need some negative thoughts. Emotions such as anger or envy can be turned around to help you change your behavior. This is somewhat related to that topic we were discussing, Julian, a couple of weeks ago about how positive thinking could have a negative effect. And now negative thinking could have a positive effect.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it?
I think too much of it probably is about too much of one. I mean, if you always think I think there's also this culture, and it's there in Hallmark cards, and it's all over that. As long as you put your mind to it, you know, you can do it. As long as you aspire, you can achieve.
You don't believe in that?
Well, no, I think that's true on one hand, but it's also true that there are structural impediments to all kinds of achievements, and therefore we need to recognize what those structural impediments are. Otherwise, we're just peddling fantasies, right?
Yeah.
So when we say to young people, you can achieve your dreams, we must always have the proviso that, you know, yes, but within certain terms. And you know, I tell young people I meet today who haven't found a job, coming out of university, who are very disappointed, that it's not their fault. Mm. The world economy is not something that anybody controls. And if they just happen to come out of, you know, during that period, they're just going to have to grit their teeth and bear it until things improve. And then, you know, then they can see where their talent matches the opportunities available.
Yeah, I think great success is always a lot of times the draw of the luck. So if you're going to sell that idea to people that, hey, you can be successful, then there'll be widespread disappointment.
Well, I think it's just about embracing the good and the bad. You know, sometimes people don't acknowledge their negative feelings, their feelings of jealousy and anger and maybe...
Yes. Which I have none.
You know, you got to come to terms with
it. Yeah, because, you know, there's this such a spin on positive thinking and feeling, you know, you've got to think good all the time.
Yeah.
Well, we're
blame
human,
it, blame
right?
it on the idea of the American dream, because
the positive psychology.
Since the 50s and the 60s, American especially has been fed with this idea that you can achieve that, you know, fantastic life that you dream of. But because today economic situations are so bad, and this is appearing on the Wall Street Journal, no less, right? The premier
financial
paper in the U.S. and saying that, hey, maybe the American dream is not so achievable after all. Possibly that's the subtext here.
Okay, it's now 6:51 a.m. We've got the Sonics coming up next with Have Love Will Travel, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.